It's Wednesday, February 5th, 2020, and this is What's the Point? On the show this week, how old are you and are you engaged? To clarify and discuss it, this week's hosts, Rick Drennan, Isaac Callan, Joel Whitnable, and Zan Graywall. Now here's Zan Graywall.
This week we're going to be talking about something slightly different than some of our usual subject matter. We want to talk about the future and specifically how millennials square up against people my generation. I'm an Xer, Rick's a boomer, and we've got Joel who's a millennial, and Isaac, who's right on the edge. When we talk about planning for the future, density, intensification, urbanization, transit, getting rid of sprawl, getting rid of gridlock, an urban plan and an urban attitude, the way we want to live, the environment that we want to live in, that conforms to the expectations of living in a clean planet, turning around the impact of human activity on our climate, the fact that temperature increase is not sustainable right now. And we realize that, you know, the cause of the day is the very future of our planet. And we wanted to address like whether or not the attitudes that many people who associate with me and Rick age-wise, generationally, some of the frustration regarding the way we live and the way we have treated our surrounding environment and the way we attitudinally and psychologically and politically and socially and culturally, the way we have come to think about, you know, our life and our lifestyles in the face of a lot of the pressures that younger people, millennials, for example, whether it's getting priced out of markets, whether it's about dealing with pollution and the future of climate change, whether it's dealing with the reality that they might not have as much as we have and they want to change the way we all live. And there's a lot of resentment from people who are younger regarding toward people my age. And that's what we're going to talk about today.
I want to jump into that straight away with an anecdote, actually, San, from a council meeting a couple of weeks ago, which I think epitomized the attitudes you're describing and how entrenched they are. So I wrote a piece recently for The Pointer about parking strategies in Brampton and Mississauga, the amount of available land both cities have saved with their parking across, accidentally by all means, and looked a bit at Mississauga's plan, a parking plan which came in 2019, was accepted by council, was very much kind of heralded at the time. And then, if you remember, about 2 weeks ago, the Globe and Mail ran a story around Go Transit looking at reducing their parking, getting rid of paid parking, the idea being to motivate people to walk towards the Go station to get transit. And it came up in this council meeting. Mayor Bonnie Crombie in Mississauga raised it, and she was concerned her daughter would have to start paying for parking when she goes to the Go station. And this discussion went back and forth between all the councillors who'd 6 months earlier approved a comprehensive review of parking, which said we need less parking, and they ended
in line with the environmental concerns that they voiced when they declared a climate emergency.
Exactly. And they ended up, partly because Bonnie Crombie was concerned about how her daughter would get to work, partly because residents were concerned about where they might park on the street, they ended up all expressing displeasure at the idea that Metrolinx would charge for parking, which would de-incentivize people from driving to the Go station. They were talking about the fact the recent redevelopment of parking at Clarkson was barely enough, and it was the idea that they had 6 months earlier read a 140-page report from staff which outlined all of the reasons to get rid of parking at Go stations, and explicitly at one point in the report talks about the need to reduce parking in line with Metrolinx to get rid of the parking at Go stations. And at the end of this discussion, not one of them mentioned the parking strategy. They were all talking just from anecdotal personal evidence about the need to find a parking spot. And I think that kind of is what you're describing, San, where logical policy comes up against these entrenched beliefs which you've grown up with and which you're cultured into.
I know that room. You know, the council chamber, those sitting around the DS in Mississauga, I've covered them for quite a while. And they're all either boomers or Gen Xers. There's not one millennial, which, you know, you would expect, like in public office, you want people who have a lived experience. They've gathered all their experience in the real world, and then they go and serve politically, like when they can give back some of that experience. So I have no problem with the fact that those counselors are, you know, older, either boomers or Xers. But here's the thing that's incredible about that. Did any of them point at the real problem? Did any of them address the fact that, look, every year when the budget for transit comes up and the decisions about My Way come up, there are a host of different things that could be done to drive up transit usage. And I don't mean just by creating more routes, but disincentives to using your car incentivizing using transit, making it more convenient. So instead of some of the arguments that they were using, if any of them thought to like say, hey, you know what? If we have a really well-functioning transit system, there is no reason for people to get in their car to go from their house to the GO train station. You will use a single pass that gets you onto a bus, right to the GO train station, onto the GO train, and off to work. That should be the goal, not like an acceptance that everyone in Mississauga, even those who use the GO train, can only get to the GO train station by car.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. When I grew up, the big term back then was generation gap. We were going to do our Depression era and war-weary parents one better because we knew everything, right? We were the boomer generation. So everything was built for us. The cities were going to be built for us. But the boomer generation, who are idealists, who are against the war in Vietnam, you know, they were the great social protesters and stuff like that.
Civil rights and women's rights.
Yeah, well, we turned into the me generation. We turned into the generation that, you know, embraced all this expansion of the suburbs and, you know, driving your car to work and eliminate or not even bothering with transit. That generation gap, I guess it's still there.
I also think that there might be an argument to be made that the next generation, the millennials, that they've taken that sort of me generation to the next level with the dawn of social media that has turned many, many people into closet or maybe an open narcissists and are really just concerned about their own, you know, personal image and sharing, you know, this is what I ate today, this is what I'm doing, instead of actually taking, you know, that energy and using it to better their community. It's more focused on the self.
I mean, have we depoliticized our world because of that now, San? I mean, it doesn't seem to be the kind of causes and the people that get behind the causes, although the talk about our environment, of course, that's something that the next generation is certainly worried about.
Yeah, and I think that that's the key question, right? Like we will always turn everything back to economic motivators, right? Economic influence and economic kind of factors that drive all of our behavior. You know, my generation, the Xers, the generation of grunge and angst and, you know, the 90s and didn't know if we had jobs in the future and all this stuff. But as soon as we did have access to the markets and jobs and, you know, we bought houses that have tripled in value and we're all living the high life. You know, my generation collectively, when I go back and I read the literature of the early 90s and the mid 90s, you know, Reagan and Dave Carsons and all of these folks that talked about reining in market forces and using like this emerging technology called the internet, you know, in the digital age, like using it for good to democratize, you know, to win more rights for individuals, to bring attention to social causes. You know, the environmental concerns weren't really reaching their peak back then, but it was on the radar. And then what happened, like you just said, Rick, we turned into our version of the me generation. You know, once we had all the accoutrements of life and everything that afforded us the trappings, the material trappings of the world, we all were co-opted and we jumped in whole hog. We dove into that beautiful water, you know, as soon as we had the opportunity. And that's the thing that I think is quite different about the millennials, is that the stakes are so much higher that if the millennials don't carry out this early commitment to fixing a lot of these problems, like even with your anger and your frustration about my generation, Rick's generation, it's going to be completely different if the millennials, once you secure that material security, once you get all your money and you make your nice salaries and you've got your houses and your cars and everything, if you guys and the next generation, the one behind you, Generation Z or whatever, if you don't turn things around, my generation didn't, Rick's generation didn't, but look at the stakes now. If you guys don't do it, we're not going to have a planet. We're going to be sucking on fumes. Our air quality will be unbreathable. We won't even have oceans that you can swim in.
Some things in life I see I don't understand. Sometimes I miss the point to things that they've planned. 'Cause I know dead fish don't swim home. When the seas get left alone. When
Listen, Sam, I got to tell you, I was at the last Wednesday, both Isaac and I were at the 2040 Vision speeches at the Rose Theater. And there's a real disconnect there. I mean, I think both of us noticed that, didn't we, Isaac? Because, you know, that we're talking about building a city for the future, basically for the millennials and for the generations after that. Yet in the crowd was all old white people, right? And so there's that major disconnect. Like, what are we doing, and where are the millennials, and why aren't they engaged in this system?
And I think Zahra Ibrahim, one of the speakers there, spoke about it a lot too, a near empty Rose Theater pack.
Yeah, she's a professional planner.
She focuses on human-centered urbanism. So her idea is that people hold the key to planning. And she was talking about the need to engage with the diversity of Brampton in the planning process to include young people, the idea that people who live in the city understand the city. And ironically, I think what the location of the Rose Theater with its, you know, rows of empty seats, only four council members, including the mayor, present for any of the talks, kind of illustrated was how much of a disconnect Brampton has and how much work these cities have to do to motivate people not to engage, but I think to motivate people to think that engaging is worth it. Because her central argument, I thought, was it's not that cities don't currently engage. It's that the way they engage is stale. It's very systematic.
Exactly.
It's surveys.
Yeah.
People don't think it makes a difference. You go to one planning meeting and you can state that you like the development on the table or you don't. It's not, you can't suggest something different. If you go to, you know, one of these zoning kind of changes, you're not allowed to suggest your own future for the place. You can just say if you like what's on the table or not. And what she talked about was exactly that, Rick. It was engaging all the people who weren't at her speech at the Rose Theatre, making them think that city planning, that growth, that all of these things are something which they can affect change within.
Why? Where is this lack of enthusiasm, though? We saw it in the last federal election, too, Sam. I mean, voter turnout was, again, over 65. They're 70 or 80% of voters. And then below that, it just keeps going down and down as we get younger and younger in the look.
Yeah, and what Rick's talking about, you know, for our listeners, is this woeful, like almost dangerous political participation level in Brampton, Mississauga, where in Mississauga it was like a little over 25%. In Brampton, I think it was around 33% of eligible voters came out and voted in the last municipal election. But then when you break it down by age, it would be like around 10, 20% of eligible voters, you know, who are in the millennial generation who actually came out and voted. You know, Joel, I think, you know, you and I have spoken about this. Joel's obviously someone who's engaged. You're a journalist. You ran a newspaper before you joined The Pointer. Now at The Pointer, you've got a lot of responsibilities as a journalist, you know, running, you know, a lot of what we do, making big decisions, you know, from the federal level to the local level, everything that's happening. And obviously you're someone who's plugged in, but when you read those types of statistics, you know, the quantitative data, the evidence that shows that a lot of people your age, and I get it. Look, you don't have children in the school system. You know, you don't have parents that, you know, are relying on the hospital and the healthcare system. Maybe you don't even have a mortgage yet. So you're not concerned about, you know, property tax issues because you don't own property. So maybe being sort of pushed out to the margins in a way is something that kind of engenders and creates the apathy, the disengagement. Like, I'm not sure.
I think, you know, a lot of people my age, which, you know, I'm 31, and a lot of people my age, like with my parents' generation, they already had three kids, they had a home, they had all of these things already. So they were plugged into a lot more stuff than I think a lot of people my age now, like a lot of my friends and a lot of my generation don't have those things. And they're still trying to get to that stage where they would have the time, you know, the time and the willingness to sort of engage with those sorts of things because they actually see them impacting their life. Like right now, a lot of people my age are still looking for jobs. They're still renting. They're either trying to save for a home or trying to figure out what they're going to do. They're maybe just starting to start a family. They maybe have young kids. So that's going to keep, you know, anyone with a young child knows that that's going to take up all of their time.
But then issues like childcare and, you know, government support for childcare or something like, you know, autism funding or all the things that are associated with having a child in terms of your public engagement with all those issues, until you have a reason to engage with those things, you're going to be disconnected.
It comes down to both being in that place to be engaged with that sort of aspect of your life, but also having the knowledge to know that those sorts of things that are making your life difficult, whether it's having a child and they need the childcare that's not there. It's having the knowledge to know that, you know, there are issues, or that it's the politicians and the leaders in power that are the ones that are making that difficult for you. Things happen, whether it's they're unable to find childcare and they just accept that that's the way that things are, and they don't question it. They don't question, okay, how can we improve this situation? For the environment, that's one of the biggest ones, because I think that in the GTA, we don't see a lot of the impacts of climate change. Maybe get experiencing a little bit of flooding if you're down in like the, near Lake Ontario and those sorts of things. You know, we may be paying a little bit more for gas, or we're paying a little bit more for food, but our houses aren't being destroyed. We're not getting uprooted and having to leave our homes. None of these things are happening.
Our air quality is still pretty good. We've actually cut down dramatically on the number of smog
because of the coal plants. Yeah,
yeah, getting rid of that. Compared to like 15, 20 years ago.
And I think that because of that, that engenders a little bit of apathy as well, because we, for the most part, live comfortable lives that aren't being impacted by these sorts of things. So why take the time to really invest or have in, or fight it?
The city builder at the Rose Theater last week, she talked about that. She talked about engaging the young people. And she went down to the street level, you know, and engaged them.
This is the thing. Before we jump into environment, because I think that is kind of a key pillar of this, I want to touch a little bit on how you framed it there, San, because I think that is how politics frames issues. And that is responsible for what you're saying, Rick. If you frame it as politics is about childcare or just schools, and it's not about those aspirational bigger pictures, it's not about something as broad as the environment, it's about how much does your gas cost because of the carbon tax, that kind of thing. When politics is framed like that, when political announcements are broken down into such small piecemeal selfish terms, it's broken down into this impacts you, this is great, you should care. It's not the broad picture, it's not the blue sky thinking which takes place. And I think that is also a very demotivating factor, is the way politicians talk. And I think the whole the middle class phraseology, very present at the last election, is extremely responsible for this. The idea that, you know, benefit for the middle class, it makes a difference, but it's so small minded. It's so based on you are an individual voter. This is what you might want.
But in terms of the politicizing of these sorts of things, here's what I find a bit surprising. You know, I look at my own two daughters and how technologically advanced they are, how sort of sophisticated in some of their intellectual sort of grasp of certain technological impacts and influences and the use of technology, the portable nature of a lot of like their skills right now. It allows them to circumvent, you know, much of the things that I was forced to be influenced by. I had the mainstream media. I had the big political parties. They kind of spoke directly to me. I didn't have levers and avenues and ways of getting around that to figure out stuff for myself. But now with social media, proliferation of other media, other types of technologies, other ways of getting information, other ways of using technology and certain strategies to devise your own ideas about policy. I'm not saying that we didn't have all that stuff, you know, in my day. We did to a certain extent, but there's so much potential to question and challenge now because the information, it's so readily available. Like, I'll give you an example. When I think of my early days in journalism, trying to find background information for an article, it was very onerous, incredibly tedious, with very limited information out there. And I've read, you know, I've read pieces of writing that have suggested there is now more accessible, publicly available data now than the entire history of humanity combined. In fact, compared to the 70s, we apparently have about 1,000 times the amount of information at our fingertips and accessible by almost anyone. And that's what makes me wonder why some younger people fall prey to that mediation by the politicians that you talked about, Isaac.
You are somebody that I don't know, but you're taking shots at me like it's Patron, and I'm just like, damn, it's 7 a.m. Say it in the street, that's a knockout, but you say it in a tweet, that's a cop-out, and I'm just like, hey, are you okay? Your self-expression, but I've learned a lesson that stressing and obsessing about somebody else is no fun. And snakes and stones never broke my bone, so oh, 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 you need to calm down. You're being too loud. And I'm just like, oh, 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 you need to just stop. Like, can you just not? My gown.
working all night. You just need to take several seats and then try to restore the peace and control your urges to scream about all the people you hate. Cause shade never made anybody less gay, so you need to calm down.
Let's say you're that young conservative in Alberta, or you're that young Republican in some oil producing state like, you know, Wyoming or, you know, wherever. And for the young conservative in Alberta, you're primarily driven by your thoughts on fiscal conservatism and the belief that, you know, through open markets and free markets, we can create a great society, great work ethic, you know, a great community. We can aspire to elevating everyone's life, you know, improving the economy, but also improving society. So if you're that young conservative, wouldn't you, like, I would think that you would be out there saying, yeah, you know what, environmental concerns, the environmental move, the movement, it's the greatest thing that probably could have ever happened to a place like Alberta. The faster that we get off our dependence from the oil sands and we capitalize on the multi-trillion dollar potential of alternative energy and green technologies, that's when we're going to get, you know, lead, we're going to get ourselves into an economic picture and a position where, you know, me as a fiscal conservative, this young person, let's say, you know, that's exactly where I want to be. And all the entrepreneurial activity that needs to be part of that and the support for the business class and government policy to make sure that that can happen, you know, for investors and entrepreneurs and everyone to do all those sorts of things. You know, I'm surprised that the technology, all the platforms, all the communication, you know, tools that are out there wouldn't see, you know, a movement of young conservatives, for example, in a place like Alberta, like pushing that agenda instead of like the tired, old, lazy, uncreative, you know, dogma and control of the oil industry that ends up now even influencing, you know, millennials.
I think you're right in a sense. I think the issue is there's a lot of ifs and buts. In our job as journalists, we have the privilege of being paid to do what you're describing. I spend probably 5 hours a day, maybe 4 or 5 hours a day, sifting through that information for a story, working out what's relevant, what's accurate, what should be included. But that takes time. And in, I think, particularly the millennial issue of all the aspirations Joel was describing trying to achieve, if you're not being paid for that time, I read a fascinating piece, and I forget what the publication was, but about the obsession millennials have with productivity. The idea that hobbies, social activities, if they're not productive, increasingly millennials move away from them. So the idea that you would do something just for fun, that you'd take up knitting because you fancied knitting, is completely disappearing. And instead it's professional development, it's career development.
It's a side hustle now. Classes. It's not a hobby. Exactly. It's something that, you know, you do on the side to try and earn money instead of just for fun.
Exactly. Yeah. You do a trivia night. Great. Is it going to turn into, you know, a business? Can you run this trivia night every few weeks? Like, it's that mentality. So I think you're completely right, San, but I think that the millennial generation has such time constraints, whether they are socially constructed or real, I think is a different debate, but they have such perceived time constraints that although all the tools exist to do exactly what you're describing, it's very low down people's agenda.
Yeah, I automatically think they don't have time for that.
And exactly. I'm gonna speak, I know I don't want to go on about this, but which I tend to do, but I'm gonna speak to that, Isaac. And I think that what you've described is at the root of the potential problem with younger generations. And we'll have to see how it turns out, because that entire experiment and, you know, the lesson that, you know, will be played out over the next 20, 30, 40 years, we don't really know how it's going to unfold. So let's see. But here's the potential pitfall. And here's what I think needs to be overcome fundamentally. Technology has never played the role in any generation that it does now. Innovation, that type of technological dynamism, you know, scientific research, advancement, you know, all of these things in this technology space, they now control our lives. And here's my challenge to millennials and those younger. Everything that Isaac described, when you're talking about needing to be productive, ask yourself, who controls the mechanisms that dictate all of that labor? all of that productivity. If these are individuals who work in technology spaces, who are simply taking the same type of boomer attitude, the same type of Gen X attitude, which was market-based, profit-driven, productivity not for social gain, productivity not to fix the problems of our world, productivity not to bring equality, you know, and human rights to individuals, but productivity simply for the sake of profits. So if you're sitting there in your tech space working for that, you know, restaurant delivery app, or you're working for that dating site app, or you're working for that graphic design and development company, or you're working at like an algorithm-based, you know, coding company that works like, you know, in the security space, you know, whatever you might be doing, the big question mark around technology now, and this isn't coming from me, you can pick up a million different books and you can Google it and everyone's talking about it, is what good is Silicon Valley if all that brain power, if all of these unbelievably gifted individuals, if all of the very technology itself, you know, is nothing more than a bunch of useless apps, you know, and things that have trivial purpose behind them. And it's not being directed at how are we going to fix climate change? How are we going to create new, you know, alternative energy technologies? How are we going to, you know, shift our entire carbon economy, you know, to what we need for the future? How are we going to plan the city of the future? How are we going to get cars off the road? How are we going to promote transit? How are we going to build transit? How are we going to get people off that dependency on parking lots and parking spaces, right? So what I'm sort of suggesting is be better than my generation has been. Be better than what Rick's generation has been, where as soon as we became the fat cats making money, that's all we cared about. Champagne and caviar, baby, you know? Vacations down in the Caribbean, jet off to Hawaii, you know? Go shop in Europe. That's all that anyone I talk to, my generation, that's all anyone cares about now. Oh, how many secondary properties do you own?
You know, it's funny. I was, I've got this little side hustle. Is that the term nowadays? Side hustle? Yeah. I write a little golf column for this golf magazine. And so I go to the PGA merchandise show down in Florida, in Orlando, and Sandwell knows it. And so, I mean, that is the boomer industry, you know, white males, old guys hogging all the tea times, you know, controlling rich. Control the industry. And so a couple of years ago, they had this guy there. His name was Jeff Fromm. And he was doing a speech, a seminar on this Enigma generation, which is the next generation. And how do you serve them? So first of all, he had to explain to these people who the Enigma generation were and what were they looking for. And so he's written a book called Marketing to Millennials, and he said that they are looking for brands that create meaning, intrigue, and offer an experience to them. And so then if you take that farther, Richard Florida, the great urbanist who is actually living in Toronto right now, he says that this younger generation, they want a different kind of city building. I mean, they want to live in a city that they can experience something, or it's like going on vacation in your own city. So it really affects our whole lives, doesn't it?
Yeah. I mean, I put this to Joel and Isaac, you know, both of you live in Toronto. Both of you identify, I think, to a great extent with stereotypical or kind of generalized millennial values. Like, what is it that you get? Like, you know, Isaac, when you were looking for a place, you know, it was pretty clear you wanted to experience Toronto. Hey, you're going to be in Toronto. I want to be right downtown. Lots of culture, live music, you know, great restaurants, arts, you know, other cultural kind of amenities, a vibe, an energy, you know, run into new people, meet interesting places, you know, individuals, I should say. Is it the sort of thing where if an urban experience doesn't represent those things, you don't want to live there? So for Brampton and Mississauga, if they can't recreate that, what Rick just described, and if that's all younger people really care about, at least in that sort of adventurous period of their life, the kind of post coming of age period of their life, they've got some independence, they're making a little bit of money. Like, what's the future of a place like Brampton or Mississauga if they can't really attract people like you guys?
I had a very similar conversation recently with a friend who I go for a drink with kind of once every week. And he is regularly very dismissive of Mississauga. And in my role with the Pointer, I have been kind of talking to him about that. And we were talking about what differentiates Toronto from Mississauga. And I was saying that with some of the lakefront developments coming up, some of the stuff in Square One, Mississauga and the Hur-Ontario LRT as well, the city is arguably on the cusp of becoming a rival to Toronto. And I can't remember the exact phrasing I used, but I basically said, if it were to get a couple of microbreweries, a few like independent restaurants in walkable areas, and say, you know, an OHL team, which it has, which people actually go and see. He kind of laughed at me and he said, yes, you're describing building a city. What you're describing is creating a whole city. And I think that is generationally the thing, is that it's not just enough to build the housing. It's great what Mississauga is doing in terms of height and density, and its transit is improving. But what was key for my friend was what may be considered the trimmings, those extra bits, the nightlife, the restaurants, which I think a lot of city builders would traditionally just leave to market forces, would assume that's the bit that fills in once you've got your city. And he described it as building a city. And I think that's a very interesting kind of generational difference on what it is. Because if you are, I mean, I rent, I can see myself renting for a very long time based on the price of housing in Mississauga and Toronto. And I think if that's what you're doing, you know, you're not looking for somewhere to necessarily settle down with children or whatever. You're looking at what's around you. The housing is actually a secondary element to it, because that can change. You can move if you're renting. You're pretty free on that front. What you're looking at is what the city around you provides. And that's not just buses and houses, if that makes sense.
You know, it's funny. I saw something on TV last week. They were talking about the Blue Jays. And they said that in a survey, 70% of the people that go to a Blue Jay game go there for the experience. They don't even watch the game. They don't care about the game. Well, for boomers, the idea was go to game and see what the final result was going to be. So that's what we're facing nowadays. So you have to really market to the new generation, right? And see what they want. They want the experience. They don't want the actual game itself. They don't care. They want all the fluff that kind of goes around it.
I also think they want the amplification of their own personal experience outwardly. So everything that certain individuals, and I'm not going to, you know, bestow this upon just millennials, but I know more and more people, I see more and more behavior where every little micro behavior, every micro action, every micro kind of movement and activity is basically amplified out to the world through their social media, you know, through other platforms. So naturally, you know, I don't know if you guys are familiar with the psychological phenomena called imaginary audience, a phase of our early adolescent development, but it's simple. It's just the notion that, you know, as adolescents, you think everyone's watching you. You think that you're constantly on a stage and everyone is always watching you on that stage. We know in reality that in adolescence, no one's watching you. Every adolescent thinks that all the others are watching them, but they're all too busy worried about this notion that everyone else is watching them to actually watch others. So there's no actual audience. But now you see that phenomenon, that kind of behavior extended way beyond adolescence. You see people in the social media realm, again, using technology that's algorithmically programmed and designed to create this kind of behavior. It's a very intentional focus of a lot of these platforms and companies to keep you swept up in that type of thinking that, oh man, if you're not tweeting constantly, if you're not putting stuff on Instagram, if you're not putting posts on Facebook, if everyone doesn't know exactly what you're doing, you're not going to be able to keep up with the Joneses. If you're not going on vacation and forgetting about like the beautiful nature of a place like New Zealand and just being gobsmacked and awestruck at like all of the beauty and the tapestry of nature and, you know, these skies that go on forever and these mountains that are just beyond majestic. If you're more concerned about getting like 8 million selfies to post them every 5 seconds, did you even experience that nature? Did you even experience what the entire endeavor was supposedly meant for? And I think the Blue Jays example and a lot of what you talked, like this buddy of yours, Isaac, like my question to that buddy who kind of scoffs at your kind of take on Mississauga is, what are you all about? Like even the city, okay, that's great. But okay, but when you have a family, when you have your own children, what is your rootedness? What is your soulful connection to the world? I think culture is one of the great things to be connected to, and arts, you know, and things like dining. But if you're not connected, like fundamentally at some level, the younger folks, the millennials, they're just going to turn into different versions of us. Where when they get all that, whether they live in an urban environment or not, eventually it's going to be all about, where'd you vacation? How many second properties do you own? You know, that new fancy car that you bought.
Social media has changed a lot of the younger generation in terms of turning people into kind of what San described, that you're always on a stage. You know, you got to take your selfies at all your events. You go to the Jays game, if that old saying, pics or it didn't happen. Like, if you don't post anything on social media, you didn't actually go. Like, what's the point of actually going if you don't take a selfie when you're there? That sort of attitude, there is starting to be a bit of a shift. A lot of the publications that I follow are starting to write more and more about the power of unplugging, having like a social media detox in terms of staying off of social media for like a week or a month, and how valuable that can be. And there's also a lot of research that's, you know, been going on for years, but now it's actually starting to get a lot more attention about the power of just being outside, going for a walk in nature and just being outdoors, and how
there's a lot of scientific and medical research that says that
big time. You know, the Pointer has written a lot about this. Rick, you wrote a great piece on it about how there's this almost this epidemic level of anxiety and depression among youth today. And these sorts of things, you know, getting off of social media, getting outside and just being outside has such power, scientifically has power to, you know, help your own physical and mental health. And I think there is starting to be a shift towards recognizing these sorts of things, which I think will eliminate a lot of that sort of social media attitude and the power of always being plugged in. Getting away from that sort of narcissistic attitude about almost what that San, you said about being on a stage. Growing up and getting out of that is the first step towards, I think, solving some of these other bigger problems that we've been talking about.
And I would argue, though, that what I described in terms of the bits that would fill out Mississauga is exactly that. Because, so I had another friend visit recently and I showed him around Toronto. And I find Toronto is a very interesting city to show someone around, because in terms of places to take your selfies, it's pretty barren. It is a place with amazing food.
Yeah, but almost all cities are, Isaac. You know, not to sound kind of pretentious, but I've been to probably 40 or 50 of the world's great, you know, big cities, right? I'm a geezer now, and I've like worked my whole life in journalism, and because of my family situation, I've been practically everywhere. And it's like, you know, at my age, for sure, if you love a particular band, like if they're your Bob Dylan and they happen to be playing, like, and you live in a place where you can just, you know, get down to see that band, you know, within 15, 20 minutes from where you live and get a ticket and go into whatever venue and experience that, that's amazing. But in general, you know, the restaurants are all different variations of the same thing. A lot of the arts and culture is the same. Like, yeah, you've got your sports team that you root for. That's great. But you know what? The things, in my opinion, that make a complete life, there is absolutely no reason why it can't be found in a place like Mississauga. But what I'm kind of trying to get at is the notion that the opposite of like a lot of the, you know, constant preoccupation with technology, the deep, deep, deep immersion into the narcissism and, you know, the selfies and the constant posting and everything. The opposite of is a certain sense of like, you know, ennui and, you know, disengagement and apathy. And neither of them, you know, are a good thing. I'm talking about be better than my generation, than Rick's generation. Because as I said, like 10, 15 minutes ago, I was amazed. Some of the people that when I was in university and around that age, who were the biggest social crusaders and eco warriors, they're now the biggest materialists. They live these soul-destroying worlds where they don't know what to do with all their money. You know, a lot of them, their kids are older now. They're bored. They go on like a million vacations. They go to the same place. They go to the same restaurants. They experience the same stuff. It's replicated all around the world. It's kind of this urban homogeneity. You know, Paris, you know, like London, all these places, like Asian countries, which I think are quite fascinating still, a lot of them, but generally, you know, I'm getting off topic, but what I'm sort of trying to get at is if the engagement of the sort of wonderment about the world and the place where you live because you want to save it and you want to make it better, if a lot of that isn't channeled into these engaging activities where you are getting out and voting, you are going to the council meeting where you say, hey, counselor, like you shouldn't be talking about preserving more parking at the GO station. You need to get on board. You were the one who passed the climate emergency declaration. Why wouldn't you be coming up with strategies to get rid of parking at the GO station?
I do think the school strikes have been a good example of what's good with young people on these issues, but also the barriers, because I think, and this is opinion more than anything else, but that the treatment of school strikers by politicians who I've spoken to by experience in Canada has put up all the barriers you've demonstrated. It has either been piggybacking on what they're doing to get credit for not doing anything, or deeply patronizing, having them in for a meeting and, you know, pretty much pretending you're taking notes and then doing nothing. No one's been genuinely listening, I don't think, in terms of municipal politicians particularly, but provincial politicians. There's a lot of virtue signaling going on around these kind of events, but this is young people who are putting their education on the line to make this statement in support of the planet. And I think that every single Gen X and boomer politician has been completely guilty of nodding quietly and just listening to music while they're talking. I don't think they're listening at all. And even the way they talk about them sometimes at meetings, they say, oh, you know, it's so lovely that we've got these young climate strikers. We had them in for a meeting yesterday. They don't say what
they're so articulate.
Yeah.
They're so well-spoken.
Not once when I've heard them raised has someone gone, well, they're particularly concerned about this. They would like change to see X, Y, and Z. They just say they've had them in for a meeting. And it's basically, you know, the mayor or a councillor has chalked off an hour of their day where they're getting nothing done because they're going to be sitting with some kids.
Why are these people getting mad? Why aren't they taking it to the streets?
Some certainly are. I think what we've seen in the last 12 months is evidence that there is certainly, and I think the protesting and democracy, it's at its fundamental level, like voicing those concerns, gathering, you know, the protests, the marches, everything. I think that's phenomenal. And I think that, you know, it's certainly a signal that, you know, there's an understanding out there and there's a growing belief that if structural changes, if fundamental changes aren't made, we're in a lot of trouble. But I do agree with what Joel said. A lot of younger people, people in my family and friends and those that I've talked to as a journalist, I do hear a lot that how are you supposed to get around sort of structures whereby you have very, very private entities, very, very powerful, you know, multi-billion dollar private entities in the private sector that have years and years and years, decades of corporate and business and transactional and enterprise dynamics that have led them to have their best interests in perpetuating the type of economy that they depend on, the supply management chain that they depend on, the consumer kind of relationship that they depend on. What are automobile manufacturers going to do? Right. You've got two types of automobile manufacturers. You've got the GM out there and you've got, like, I guess, let's say the Tesla. If you're a GM, are you saying, yep, you know what? We're going to get off the internal combustion engine, our carbon based automobiles. We will be the pioneers. We will be the ones who are going to completely change the entire dynamic of the auto industry. So if you're a young person, you could get behind GM if they're going to do that. But what I find amazing, I was looking at sales data. And if you're a young person and you're looking and you're thinking, wow, the largest growth sector in the North American automobile market, it's in heavy trucks, these pickup trucks and 4x4s. These things are selling like hotcakes, V8s. I mean, sometimes V12s. You think that the big, you know, the big three or any other automaker, when they're making like billions and billions and billions of dollars in one quarter off the sales of these vehicles, you think when that profit is sitting there for you, that you're going to say, yeah, you know what, we're going to develop an entire line of purely electric heavy trucks?
This is
no,
where,
they're not.
This is where, for regular listeners, we go back to last week's podcast and the marketization almost of climate change by these companies. There was a news story yesterday that popped up that the British aviation industry is going to be carbon neutral by 2050. That doesn't mean they're going to fly fewer planes. It means they're going to plant trees and have more efficient engines. And the idea that it is better for these power interests, it's cheaper for these power interests to come up with these pseudo green policies which market really well, which play really well, which just about placate the people who are protesting. The idea that that is cheaper than developing an electric engine, I think, is also one of the barriers. The idea that you can do just enough to keep people happy without actually making any sort of revolutionary change.
But what I don't get, and what San probably doesn't get, or what a lot of older people don't get, is that the millennials don't even want cars.
When the millennials got, like, you know, a $250,000 job all of a sudden, and they've got like $1 million in equity in their house, and they've got $500,000 in their investment portfolio, that's when we'll be able to figure out what they're all about.
I don't know. If you look at the numbers, it just shows that the millennials are not interested in that stuff. They're, like you said, they like to rent instead of buy. They don't like to buy cars. They'd rather take transit. So they're looking for...
And then
for,
if they need a car, they can get a car hire.
Yeah, that's
whatever.
That's what they'll do. Yeah. They look for other opportunities. Like I said, they're looking for some kind of an experience for that. Whereas we think, oh yeah, we got to have a car. Got to get the kids to school. Got to, you know, do this, got to do that.
God forbid, like, you could have to, like, take an alternative mode of transportation to drop off a parcel or to do your groceries or to get to your nearest place for coffee. Or, you know, I don't want to be too personal about this, but I know so many people in the 905 who would never think of using the GO train. They go into downtown Toronto, basketball games, to shop, to go out for a party, friend's house, whatever. They would never, ever even consider. And, you know, and I've said to some of them, I've said, you know, it's actually way more convenient.
Well, I remember when I joined the Pointer in September, San, and to an extent Joel as well, the number of worried emails I had about the fact that I couldn't drive, the fact that I was going to be covering Mississauga and Brampton without a car. And I think that is the difference between having a car and not. I can't drive. I don't have a license. I don't have a car. And it takes me longer to get places in Mississauga and Brampton. Don't get me wrong. It's still quicker by car. But I think if you have that option to drive, your thought process just doesn't extend as far as the feasibility. I was living in Port Credit originally, and getting to Bramalea for, like, regional council meetings, it took time. It took two or three buses sometimes, but it costs $3.10. Like, it's not complicated. You can sleep on the bus. You can do some of your reading on the bus. And because I didn't have a car...
I'm guessing you did reading.
I was doing it. I did reading. What I mean is that, and I guess we come back to the GO parking and to de-incentivizing, is that in places like Brampton and Mississauga, we are decades off it ever being easier to take transit than to drive. And so the key to this forward city planning, to millennial friendly city planning instead of city planning based around boomers, it comes down to de-incentivizing, I think.
You see this guy, this guy's in love with you. Yes, I'm in love. Who looks at you the way I do? When you smile, I can't tell, we know each other very well. How can I show you I'm glad I got to know you? 'Cause I've heard some talk, they say you think I'm fine. Yes, I'm in love, and what I'd do to make you mine, tell me now, is it so? Don't let me be the last to know. My hands are shaking.
To any listeners out there, you know, if you are someone who identifies with some of these, you know, these issues and some of the dilemma around this and a lot of the hypocrisy, you know, what I would say to you is, in Brampton and Mississauga, you have two councils. each of them, so your locally elected officials, you know, elected almost overwhelmingly by people who are in retirement age, boomers, seniors, that's who elected these folks into council. So they represent you. But one thing I would say to any of you, you know, who have pretty serious concerns about the decisions being made in your community regarding climate change and the environment and sustainability and our futures, I would say you've got two councils, each of them declared in council formally a climate emergency. So every time they make a decision that contradicts that declaration, for example, the Mississauga councillors who don't want to disincentivize the use of parking at the GO station, who don't want to come up with, you know, more sophisticated strategies to get at the root problem to eliminate the use of the car at all when you're commuting. If you're using the GO train, well, why don't you like eliminate the car trip between your house to the GO train station? So councillors who don't get that, put pressure on that, point out their contradiction, point out their hypocrisy. Don't let them get away with the lip service on the climate emergency declaration, which is nothing more than, you know, meaningless pandering, you know, to younger people or those concerned about the environment. If it doesn't come with any real policy, any real leadership, any bold decisions that back up, you know, that decision, if it's clear it's nothing more than lip service, don't let them get away with it. If in Brampton, they do the exact same thing, declare the climate emergency, and then in the same meeting, voice approval for the GTA West Highway, a new 4-series highway that, if built, will be the most environmentally degrading thing done in the 905 in the last 30 years. Don't let them get away with it. Like, I just say to you, everything that we've talked about today, it all ultimately is about the fact that the change, the beautiful community that we want to live in, like the great urban city, where we want to call home, like our country, if we want it to be a place that's both an amazing experience to live in, where your community, you know, envelops you and surrounds you and your children, yet it provides all the experiences that you want, plus everything that's part of that community and its future also lends to a cleaner environment, you know, a better future for our planet. None of that's going to happen. You're not going to get any of that if you sit idly on the sidelines like my generation and let the so-called leaders, driven by their own interests, do things that run counter to all of those other values. Sorry, Rick, I was cutting you off.
No, it's okay. I mean, it's funny, you know, a few years ago when I was working for the Mississauga Business Times, the city of Mississauga asked me if I'd be a judge at their Urban Design Awards. So I went there, talked to some people. We had a meeting. We traveled around the city. And I started talking to some of the people, some of the other judges, right? And so the year before, they picked an above-ground parking garage as their Urban Design Award. And I was thinking as I'm driving around there looking at this, and I thought, what would the next generation think of this? Picking, first of all, the fact that they did that, this ugly above ground parking lot, why would you have a parking lot anyway? And why would you certainly give it any kind of an award? But that's the kind of the way of thinking of the boomer generation or the older generation.
I just want to add quickly to what you said there, San, which is just that there's no way that your vote counts more than the municipal level right now. Mississauga turnouts of around 25, Brampton's a little higher in the low 30s. There's no other election where if you haven't voted before, your vote is going to count as much as it does. The margins to get rid of a councillor who you think is making decisions which don't affect the city you want, they're pretty tiny.
And yeah. I would argue that there's no other level of government that impacts your immediate life, your direct experience, what's happening in your backyard, than the municipal level of government. You know, at the federal level, we can talk about a carbon tax, you know, and a carbon tax policy, which is great. But I'll give you an example. I would like to know how the local planning, which is all going to be done, you know, at the regional level, if at the regional level. So if those Brampton and Mississauga councillors vote down or do not support the 4-series highway, it's possible that they could allow it to stop, you know, prior to it coming into Peel. You know, if the province really wanted to kind of push it, I suppose they could override some local planning. But let's put it this way. If the local politicians really, really didn't want it, it could be stopped at that level. And I can tell you, I don't really see how the Four Series Highway is aligned with the federal liberal policy in terms of, you know, a lot of the environmental initiatives and climate change initiatives, including the carbon tax that it's trying to pursue. Like, I'll give you a quick example. That Four Series Highway, it's not just all the gridlock and trucks and commercial trucks and cars that are going to be like idling on that highway.
Development that comes
all
after.
The development around it. Like, that is the worst polluting element to what we're facing, you know, driving sprawl out even further, driving the commute times out even further. All of, as Joel said, the pollution creating development, whether it's industrial commercial or, you know, subdivision, which is a sprawling model, not a dense, sustainable type of development. So if you want to affect change, the municipal level, it's the perfect place to get engaged.
But I think there's still that gap there, that problem between generations. And I don't know how you solve that unless these people become more enlightened at the top end, the older end, and the young people at the other end become more engaged.
As a journalist, we read and we research these sorts of things, and we're supposed to remain objective, but I'm not reporting here. This is a podcast, so I can offer my personal opinion. With these sorts of things, these are the sorts of things that my generation should be getting angry about. You have politicians who are making six figures a year, making decisions that are completely detrimental to your future. We have developers who own this land who are going to just completely degrade and destroy not only the environment up around that area, which is directly adjacent to the green belt, but also this highway has the potential to destroy the environment throughout Peel region. The watersheds, their headwaters are right in that area, and that directly feeds throughout the entire region.
And I think this is the last thing I'm going to say. You guys can add to this, but this is my last point. You know, two younger generations, whether it's Generation Z or millennials, you know, I would say all of that technology, this is your technology. This is sort of your technological kind of economic space. You will shape it. Don't let, you know, some of the tech giants, don't let people who have very little interest in a lot of the good that we're talking about, don't let them dictate things. Don't be mesmerized and seduced, you know, by the technology that renders you into some kind of selfie posting, drooling idiot. Be someone that uses the technology in an empowering way. Co-opt them. Co-opt Facebook. Co-opt Twitter. Isaac, I think, did a really good piece during the federal election where he said he was amazed that, you know, we had, you know, some youngish candidates like Kamal Khera's in her 20s and who else would be, I think Gagan Sakhan's pretty young, like in his 30s. And we had others that were, you know, probably millennial-ish. You know, you wrote a piece saying that you were amazed at how their social media strategy, it was so pathetic. There was no innovation, no creativity. It wasn't used in all of the amazing ways that it could have. It was basically just like taking the party line, taking the press releases and dumping them on Twitter, taking, you know, the latest like memo from headquarters, you know, and dumping it on Facebook instead of all of the engaging things they could have done. You know, they could have been surveying young people. They could have been running other polls. They could have been asking young people like what they wanted to, you know, address in terms of the politics of the day. They could have been asking young people like what should these politicians, if elected, be introducing in terms of new legislation, in terms of, you know, new policy. They didn't do any of that. They used social media and the technology in a way that made them look brainwashed. And that's the last thing I'm going to say. You know, my take of the younger generation, I have two daughters. I think that you're the promise. You are the future. I don't want to sound too corny, but fulfill that potential and like, use the technology. Don't let it use you.
This week's show was hosted by Rick Drennan, Joel Whitnable, Isaac Callan, and San Graywall. Produced by yours truly. Music from Taylor Swift, You Need to Calm Down. The band New Music with Dead Fish Don't Swim Home. The Shins gave us Australia. Helena Beat from Foster the People. And the classic Burt Bacharach Hal David tune done by Herb Alpert and the Tijuana Brass, This Guy's in Love with You. I'm Jeff Chalmers. Thank you for listening. See you next time. Ba-da, ba-ba-da.